Well, I think this talk isn't going to be about anything, so I hope it's not boring. I don't get to give talks very often, so I always end up wanting to give a talk about what seems like the most critical thing, which for me seems to be to not think anything actually exists specifically. So then that's what my talk ends up being, which feels kind of a bit vague. But anyway, hopefully. So the verse that we just recited, when we were up at Jikoji just recently, a few of us kind of mentioned this verse, where it says, having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. And that really is about us, the people who are listening to the talk, that this is our opportunity to hear something, you know. It's not really anything much about the person giving the talk. It can be a bad talk, it doesn't matter. We can still hear something, you know, like the task for us is to see if there's just one sentence, one gesture, just one thing in that talk that maybe helps crack just a little bit of whatever our deluded thinking might be. And I was thinking about how I've been practicing for about 20 years, and in some ways, well, absolutely, I feel like a very slow learner, but not in the conventional sense of being a slow learner, more like really, not so much slow to learn things, but really slow to unlearn things. Really slow to unlearn. Because I keep being surprised how I'm learning more, how to dismantle my delusions more and more. Like the more I am sitting here, the more just subtly little aspects of my distorted views of thinking that I exist and other people exist specifically, the more I sit in more subtle ways, that just is falling away, just gently falling away more and more. And I think I had really very much a sort of a marketplace type of practice, and in the last 6 months or a year, it's getting more temple focused, more temple centered, and I think that is helping. And I think a clue that we might be on the right track with this kind of unlearning process is that we feel more joy, you know, feel more joy. And I notice that I have been feeling a lot more joy. So when people say, "How was your day?" I say, "Good." "How was your week?" "Good." "Did you have a good weekend?" "Yeah, I had a great weekend." Like it's like wow, this is going on weeks and weeks at a time now. That's yeah, I'm great. You know? And it's not terribly much to do with circumstances, really. I mean, a little bit. I'm sure if something really bad happened, I wouldn't feel quite so cheerful. But it's not a lot to do with circumstances. I really don't think it's more to do with our perception of circumstances. And I got a little feeling of that when I went to the dentist the other day, and he said, "Oh, we're going to have to pull that tooth out." And I went, "Oh, okay." And then he said, "Yeah, probably got two or three other ones that are going to have to come out pretty soon too." And I went like, "Okay." And I was just like, "Okay, see you later." And I just wandered out of the dentist perfectly happy. It didn't bother me. Just like didn't ruffle my mind. And I thought, my goodness, if I had this sense of me as a person who's 56 years old, who's getting old, oh my God, losing her teeth, that's so terrible. If I had that, you know, a solid sense of that, then I would have been really upset. Like, oh my God, how am I going to slow this process of dying down? I don't like it. But I just didn't have that reaction. It was just like, oh, this is life, of course, it's going to happen. I was completely cheerful. It was just kind of surprising. I don't think it was dissociation. I think it was just genuinely, I genuinely didn't really care terribly much. Felt very grateful that I was going to be able to have it done by someone, you know, with anesthetic, and it won't be a pair of pliers. You know. So So this is a book that we are studying in our Jewels of the World group that meets once a month on a Thursday evening. And they're letters that he's writing, I think, mostly to other teachers. So it's kind of interesting seeing this inside world of teachers talking to each other. All the myriad things are neither opposed to nor contrary to your true self. Directly pass through to freedom, and they make one whole. It has been this way from time without beginning. The only problem is when people put themselves in opposition to it and spurn it and impose orientations of grasping or rejecting, creating a concern where there is none. This is precisely why they are not joyfully alive. If you can cut off outward clinging to objects and inwardly forget your false ideas of self, things themselves are the true self, and the true self itself is things. Things and true self are one suchness, opening through to infinity. So this sort of sense of that I am everything and everything is me creates a lot of joy. In the Noble Eightfold Path, the first one is right view. So we're like, what is right view? This is a very interesting question for us to just keep on pondering and not necessarily specifically answering. You know, I think it might be just that I'm not very capable of specifically answering it, but I think in general it's probably wise to not think that we could specifically answer what right view is. But we can keep on having a sort of subtle, curious, open mind and keep on just asking, oh, what is this? And I think maybe it can feel a little bit abstract to talk about what is the nature of reality. It might feel a little bit clinical or cold in some way. But I think it is... because we don't examine the nature of reality and we have this delusion that things specifically are and that people can be enemies, that we have war and that we have arguments and that we have clinging and grasping to things, and all the troubles that we have in the world are because this question isn't looked at. You know, people aren't looking at this question as much as I think we would all benefit from. So it actually, by looking at this question that seems kind of abstract, I think it actually generates a deep kindness and connectedness in us when we do that. Another regular class here is Monday morning's study group where we study Nagarjuna, and I'd like to just read a few little bits from that. At the beginning, the author is reminding us that that the whole purpose of this is to cultivate this deep kindness. It is not just an interesting project to try and understand what happens when we perceive things, but that it has a deeper sort of purpose and a natural unfolding of kindness in the end. So, whatever activity we engage in, our motivation is very important. According to the tradition of Mahayana Buddhism, the motivation we should cultivate is bodhicitta, the mind turned towards supreme enlightenment. One way to do so is to think first of our father and mother in this lifetime, and then extend the love and compassion we feel for them to all sentient beings, including even our enemies. It is the case that all sentient beings, including our enemies, have been our father and mother countless times, and therefore they have been indescribably kind to us countless times. The greatest thing we can do to repay sentient beings' kindness is to lead them all to the state of complete and perfect enlightenment, the state of Buddhahood, And in order to do this, we must listen to, reflect upon, and meditate on the teachings of the genuine Dharma with all the enthusiasm we can muster. I'm very big on enthusiasm. Be enthusiastic about your practice. It pays off. I'm sure you've all heard this many times, this idea of everybody has been our mother and father. And although that's not particularly strong, I think, in the Zen tradition, we can just take it as metaphor that that everything is so interdependent and transforms so constantly, even just in a literal sense, over the billions or millions of years that the planet has been here. All the matter has just been reconfiguring, like over and over and over, far more than our mind could ever possibly imagine. So even just from that kind of a literal sense about matter on this planet, all of us have been connected to each other in so many ways that we can't possibly imagine. So looking at it from that sense, we can try and cultivate a sense of connection to things rather than aversion to people or events. And so kind of what I'm describing is connected to the emptiness teachings or the middle way teachings, so I'll read another paragraph. In fact, the terms middle way and emptiness are synonyms. Middle way means that the true nature of the phenomena we experience lies in the middle between all possible extremes that can be conceived of by the intellect. The true nature of reality cannot be described by any conceptual fabrication, by any conventional term or expression. Thus, it is not existent, not non-existent, not something, not nothing, not permanent, not extinct. It is not the lack of these things, and it is not even the middle between them, for that is a conceptual fabricated extreme as well. The true nature of reality transcends all notions we could ever have of what it might be. This is also the ultimate understanding of the second turning's description of emptiness. Emptiness ultimately means that genuine reality is empty of any conceptual fabrication that could attempt to describe what it is. So even if we don't understand something like that, or we don't know how to approach it, or even if we're not sure if we like it, we can still just consider it. You know, we can still just go like, oh, it appears like everything is the way it is. There's a conventional way of viewing the world, but what would it be like if I really did contemplate that it might not be so? And we can just keep doing that. We don't have to be sure about it. It's not like high risk. It's not a high risk activity to contemplate the emptiness teachings. It's not going to, we're not going to get thrown under a bus because we contemplate the emptiness teachings. Like nothing bad will happen. We can just contemplate them and see what happens. Yeah. I do think there's a bit of a fear of these teachings. I've felt a fear of them, and the two fears that have come up for me is a sense that I will become feel indifferent if I contemplate these teachings too much, and the other fear is that somehow things will become chaotic if I contemplate these teachings too much. But my experience for myself and what I've observed in others who have contemplated these teachings a lot is not in any way that they are indifferent or that they are in any way chaotic. It actually, my experience for myself and what I've seen in others is just this, a really an increase in care and an increase in a sense of preciousness about things. And I was thinking about how in the conventional sense of things being impermanent, just in the conventional sense that all of us are fairly familiar with but do tend to like to deny, that things are born, that they kind of do stuff, things happen, then they die. just in that conventional sense. Even within that, when we see something like a little toddler who's running around playing and they're having a great time and they're all excited, we feel this real part, I think, what happens. We have this heartfelt, beautiful feeling towards them because we kind of know it's not going to last. You know, we sort of know, oh, the school of hard knocks is going to take the edges of happiness off of them a little bit, you know. But because it's temporary and we can see that it's temporary, it kind of brings out, I think, a feeling of real love and appreciation because it's temporary. Even just in the conventional sense, it does that to us. Like, well, maybe if we do a trip, we go to a country we haven't been to before, we know we're not likely to ever go there again. And while we're there, we're like, wow, look at that mountain and look at these buildings, the architecture's incredible. We really appreciate it because we know we're not going to get to spend much time with it. It's just short-lived, you know. For us, for our experience, it won't be for long. So if we could imagine that sense of attention and preciousness that we give to things that we know we're only going to have a short experience with, a short amount of time with, like maybe you have a favorite musician and you go to a concert, you're just like, you're galvanized listening to their music because you know, oh my God, it's the only time I'm going to get to hear them or see them. You know? What if we could have that sense all the time because we could see each object and each person as just in that moment, just arising, like almost arising and disappearing, moment by moment. That each moment is a complete new one, over and over and over. And we're just like, each time it's like, whoa, there's Stan, whoa. You know? It's fresh every single time. And I think when we do contemplate that things are not as solid as they appear, we start to have that feeling more where things we just feel so much appreciation. We just feel this appreciation for everything and everyone. And maybe, I haven't really thought about this too much just now, but maybe even less aversion and less anxiety about things that are problematic for us. Because I think if we can see them as less solid and ourselves as less solid, then maybe it just doesn't cause as much fretfulness in the mind as well. That would make sense. So another thing that I found helpful for myself is really relaxing in the unknowability of it all and just practicing relaxing with not knowing rather than, even though I really am enjoying studying and trying to understand through the Buddhist teachings different ways of describing reality or maybe more accurately different ways of describing how reality isn't, I still also like to just back away from all of that and just rest in a complete unknowing kind of a place and just see how that feels to not have any particular ground under my feet. Oh yeah, and I made a note here. And then we have to be careful just when we think that we've kind of got this whole idea of how not to not know things, to not somehow think now we've got it. We've got the idea of how not to not know and not rest there. So it's just this continual relaxing into not knowing over and over and over and over. Keeping on unlearning, just unlearning, unlearning over and over and over. Someone who gave a talk here, I don't know how long ago, maybe a year or so ago, Jiru, he did an article recently that I thought was very interesting called There Is No Clear, No Seeing Clearly. There is no seeing clearly. And in this short article, he's speaking a little about how we do have a lot in our teachings about, and suddenly it all became clear, suddenly, you know, everything dropped away and we could see clearly. I think that, you know, that's part of our teachings. And so he's describing, and I don't know if I'm doing this justice because I can't read the whole thing out, so I'm just paraphrasing a little bit. He's describing how even in his own experience of having moments of feeling very of clarity, that even in those moments of clarity, and we read about them of, you know, awakened teachers and people having a very deep practice, having a sense of feeling very unified and everything being clear and a sense of a separate self really fully dropping away. He's sort of saying maybe we should just, even then, even if we've had experiences like that, just err on the side of thinking, no, maybe even then I didn't see clearly. It felt like I did, but maybe even then, even in that moment of strong awakening experience, maybe even then I didn't see clearly. And I kind of like that. So I'll just read a little quote from the end. He says, "Am I sure I saw clearly? Are you sure you saw clearly? On what basis are we so sure? Is that basis outside the realm of influences of thinking, of expectation, of conditioning? And to what extent, and to the extent that I still object, that I still really do swear that though I'm not quite yet a Buddha, I still once or twice manage this feat of clear seeing, I should consider this too. Isn't the position there is no clear seeing 100% safer, more solid, more skillful, and more trustworthy than the alternative? If we don't accept that we can't ever see clearly, what's to keep us from falling back into that worn-out, war-making delusion that me, for one, I see clearly?" So I just like that as a caution, just as a skillful means, because maybe we actually do see clearly, but it might be better to not know whether we did, you know. So we did, but it's better for us to say, oh, I don't know if I did. Maybe I didn't. So I did send him a little note saying, that was a great article, possibly. In our Friday koan study class, what are we doing for time? Doing good. We are on case 41 in the Gateless Barrier, the Mumonkan. Bodhidharma pacifies the mind. And this is a very well-known case. Many of you know this one. Bodhidharma faced the wall. The second ancestor stood in the snow, cut off his arm and said, "Your disciple's mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please put it to rest." Bodhidharma said, "Bring me your mind and I will put it to rest." The second ancestor said, "I have searched for my mind, but I cannot find it." Bodhidharma said, "I have completely put it to rest for you." So I just want to go through sort of line by line and just say a few things. We can't spend much time with it, but just a few things. So Bodhidharma faced the wall. And obviously the second ancestor was very impressed with that, felt that there was something about that. And I want to read a comment that Robert Aitken Roshi made about that. "The practice of facing the wall is retained literally in the Soto sect today, as we all do when we face the wall here, and in spirit by all earnest Zen students. This is not merely to avoid distraction. Whatever you are facing can be the wall. Your eyes go out of focus and the wall is no other than your practice, your breath counting, your shikantaza, your koan. As the wall comes closer and closer, it becomes more and more intimate. At last, it is the wall itself sitting on your cushions and the practice is doing the practice." So whatever we're facing is our wall. So Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. If we just walk around contemplating what is this? What happens when my eyes rest on an object? What is going on there? If we do that day in and day out, that's us facing the wall. We can do it for 9 years and be like Bodhidharma. We can just be doing that, facing the wall over and over and over. Because everything that happens is perfectly enough for us to awaken. We don't need to go to any other place to do it. So whatever is arising, we can just contemplate what's happening with our ears, what's happening with our eyes, wherever we are. So the second ancestor stood in the snow, cut off his arm. So sometimes, you know, in these cases, it feels a little bit disturbing, something like cutting off the arm. But if we think about how we're kind of attached to our arms, you know, we're attached to them. And we're attached to other stuff too. And if we can practice loosening our attachment to things that are not actually especially good for us, we can practice that, loosening our attachment to things. And there's lots of teachings. We know all the different teachings about ways that we can loosen our attachment. You know, our precepts give us guidelines for how to do that. That's cutting off our arm. You know, that's cutting off our clinging attachment to things. That's cutting off our aversion to things, so that then we can settle the mind and really meet Bodhidharma in ourselves, meet Bodhidharma in ourselves. And so he says, you know, your disciple's mind has no peace as yet. And this is a long-term practitioner, but still he notices that his mind is not fully at peace. I beg you, Master, please put it to rest. And Bodhidharma says, bring me your mind and I will put it to rest. And I think here mind is referring to more the sort of mind in the relative sense, just our individual mind, our sense of ourselves as a different person. Bodhidharma says, bring me that mind. Bring it to me and I'll put it to rest for you. And so he goes off probably for a long time and contemplates again, a bit like facing his own wall. What is this? What is this mind that sees things, that hears things, that has thoughts? And he comes back to Bodhidharma and says, I've searched for my mind, but I cannot find it. So of course that's the beautiful thing, to search for our mind and not find it. That's the beautiful thing, to realize there's not this separate mind, there's just one mind. And Bodhidharma says, I have completely put it to rest for you. He'd already put it to rest himself, he just didn't quite know it, he just needed Bodhidharma to go, pop! And then he got it. It's a quote from Dogen. To what shall I liken this life? Moonlight reflected in a dewdrop shaken from a crane's bill. Isn't that beautiful? I like to do a slow-mo thing, like imagine this crane, shaking its bill. The dew has settled on it, he's been asleep, or she's been asleep all night. And then like, and a little dewdrop, lands somewhere. And the moon is still up. It's early morning, but the moon is still there, reflected in that dewdrop. There it is. And then the moon fades, because the morning light starts to come. The sun's not even up yet, but just that morning light, and then you can't see the reflection in that dewdrop anymore, and then it evaporates. So we can liken our lives to that, and lives of everybody else. Not tomorrow night, but the following Thursday, we're having the first of hopefully many discussion groups on climate change. It's called Climate Change, Climate Justice, and Buddhist Practice. And, you know, this planet is just like that dewdrop. It's just like that. It's just this little whew from the crane's bill, and it'll evaporate. So I hope we notice this planet before it's gone. And I hope we learn to love it and enjoy it, this brief moment in time that we have it. I think that's all I have to say. Would anyone like to make a comment or ask a question? Kathy?
By your term unlearning that you brought up in the beginning of the talk. And I'm wondering if you could share an example So I can better understand how unlearning is currently working for you in your life.
It's funny because once you kind of unlearn something, it's hard to remember what it used to be like. Well, I can describe my experience like a little while ago. I sort of mentioned this in the talk, I had a sense of impermanence, that things, you know, go away and to appreciate them while they're here. But my time frame was kind of a little bit large. It's like it's here maybe for a few months or a few years. It's kind of a bit of a bigger time frame. I had a sense that when I talk to someone that they might die, it might be the last time I see them, so to be aware of how I interact with them, that kind of thing, which I think is wonderful practice. You know, we should all be doing that all the time, being aware that no matter who we're cranky with, anything could happen to them, you know. I'll just share a little story about that because it was so powerful that when my sister, she had, just before she passed away, she had an altercation with someone about their dogs. They met in a park and there was some problem. And this person was very upset with her. And then my sister passed away and I was at her house dealing with all the matters of what you do when someone passes away. And the phone rang and my voice sounds like my sister's voice. So I answered the phone. I just said hello. And the person was just angry over the phone, thinking that it was my sister. And I was able to say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, Melanie has passed away. And I just really felt for that person that suddenly, like, whew, wind went out of them, you know, because the object of their anger was suddenly no longer there. And I have no idea what that person did, but my deep hope for them was that that was a beautiful learning experience. That was my hope for them. So, but recently, I feel like I'm unlearning even more, so that I'm starting to see things, unlearning the sense of permanence even more, so that I'm seeing things like each moment it seems to be more fresh. Not just like my glasses are broken here because Jiao Jiao, our dog, broke a bit off a couple of weeks ago. And when he did it, he looked so guilty. He was sitting in a chair. He wouldn't look at me. What have you done? I couldn't find anything. It wasn't obvious. And then later on that night, like, oh. But I can appreciate the beauty of these glasses. Like, it's fresh every moment. It's not just fresh between it, before it got broken and then after it got broken. That's one time frame. But it can be fresh every time. Like, wow, glasses. You know? So I don't know if that helps. It's a sense of increasing and unlearning about permanence. Just getting more subtle about how impermanent it all is. Charles.
I was just thinking that you learn to cling to things. Mm-hmm. If you can remember when you were young and some items that became yours were given to you or you acquired them in some way, and you became very close to the clinging. You coveted them at first, and then they became yours. In that state, you felt a joy, a purpose, a significance, maybe even an identity. If you can remember those experiences, you can use them to unlearn that clinging.
Yeah.
And that's an unlearning that you can practice in that memory.
Yeah, that's a great example. Mm-hmm. And that leads me to think too about how we can reflect on experiences that cause us distress and reflect on the distress, because I think another helpful thing is that whenever we're distressed, we could say that there's delusion involved in that distress. I think other than just immediate pain, you know, if you fall over and cut yourself, just the immediate pain will cause some distress. But as soon as there's the added pain, like, oh, I'm such an idiot for falling over, why didn't I be more careful? As soon as we add something like that and have that extra distress, we could say that's the process of delusion when we do that. That's the process of thinking that there is a separate self and there are these events and things. So, yeah, we can reflect on when we're unhappy and look at, like, what is going on? What error am I making that I'm feeling unhappy? What's the error? I've often done that, asked myself that. I can't always answer it, but I ask it, and then I think that's helpful. Keeps our mind flexible, this idea of flexible mind, keeping the mind flexible all the time, not in a habitual mind. Thank you. Pranav.
How is unlearning actually different from learning? And is
it? Well, it feels different because it's sort of the way I often visualize it is it's like I've got lots of thin veils, sort of invisible to everybody else, but enough that they cloud my vision a little bit. I've got all these veils over me, and that as I unlearn, I'm pulling them, stripping them away. And what's left is something that's already complete, and already complete. Doesn't need anything to be added. It's already complete. Because it's not just this limited body. Because when we strip away the veils, we're expanding our vision to be inclusive of everything. And then how can we find fault? We're talking about absolutely everything. What fault could it be? There's nothing to compare it to call it fault. There could be no fault. Whereas learning something is more like adding something, which is also very useful, I think, on just a day-to-day level. We need to learn things, but it's just, it's a little different. Maybe, but I could be wrong. Jamie.
I've been studying, just beginning to study equanimity. I would consider myself a very, 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 very junior student. And in the context of the compulsion to see things as right or wrong, as enemy or friend, I don't quite understand. I can recognize, not to bring up the subject of politics, but I can recognize that my judgment that one person is wronger than another or that one is righter than another is pretty arbitrary and not based on much information and so forth and so on. So I can kind of let some of that veil go. But on the other hand, I think I've learned, apropos of learning, that I was supposed to discern. So it seems like a veil comes off and then I just add it back on again. Mm-hmm. Because, oh no, this is bad and I have to be moral. So in order to be moral, I have to be strongly right and wrong. I just wonder if you have a comment.
Yeah. Kind of thought someone might ask a question about politics. But it's very powerful, particularly right now. Politics is very powerful, and it does tend to encourage a very our conventional mind to be very active. It definitely does that, and I think for myself, I tried to do a number of things at once. I remember that I've taken on the Bodhisattva vows, which is to help relieve suffering of all beings without exception. And that has to be without exception. So then I might have a preference, I might have a political preference from that position of wanting to alleviate suffering. And it's more likely to be that I'm looking for in the people, the candidates and so on, who amongst them is aligning with what appears to be Buddhist teachings that do lead to greater joy. You know, so I'm looking for that with an awareness that I can't be possibly sure that I'm right or wrong about any of it. But I still nevertheless will, I think it's still good for us to take action sometimes. We just need to do it with, I think, a humble approach. But it doesn't mean we don't do anything. Is that helpful?
Yes, especially if I'm taking the lessons of unlearning, and I think also if I remember what you last said about possibly not.
Yeah.
It seems to change daily, but if I have a notion of what will be good or what will be bad or what will be right or what will be wrong, and then I can remember that how how limited is my vision and so forth, then maybe that can make, I can be more, is the adjective equanimous? I mean, I don't
know. Equanimous?
Yeah.
Yeah. And another little, I don't know where I got this from, we'll call it a tip, a little tip that might be helpful with all of this is, I focus on saying what I think is good about something, and I refrain from saying what I think is bad about something else. So rather than saying, I don't like this person because they're to such and such and so, this person's way better, I just say, this person's amazing, I really like what they're doing, I really like what they stand for, I think they're very beneficial, da da da, and I just keep doing that. Right. And I don't engage at all in what's bad about someone else. I just, zero energy goes there. I just don't, no energy goes there. Because I don't need to do that. From a Buddhist perspective, they are me anyway. I don't want to speak ill of them. Because they are me. Even if they're making choices that really may cause a great deal of harm, I don't want to be part of a voice. I just don't have the skill to do it. Maybe someone else could do it skillfully, but I know for myself that I don't think I could do it skillfully. I would be causing harm. I don't know how to do it without causing harm. But I can definitely be proactive by saying what I think is beneficial about something. So that's just, I think, a sort of a safe approach to take around politics. Yes.
Contemplating everyone as your mother or father until I realized I just came over here with a feeling of adversarial relations with my landlord. I was like, oh. Okay. So it like just really changes the whole question instead of attributing motives to them and they're, you know, just assuming, speaking poorly, silently in my mind, you know, they're acting out of a desire to keep their wealth, and I have to scheme and figure out how to play this one. Drop it all for right now.
Yeah. I have found it helpful in those sorts of situations to just remember that everybody is trying to be happy. That's all everybody is doing, no matter what they're doing, whether they're hitting someone over the head with a rock, they're still trying to be happy. It just doesn't look like it. You know, so that's still what they're doing. And that I think can open a little bit of compassion. It doesn't mean that we endorse anything, but it does open up a little bit more compassion that we're all struggling to find ways to be happy, and we do it in ways that are very unsuccessful, and we harm each other in that process, but that is still what's driving people. And in a sense, that is a deep expression, I think, of some deep knowing that we are all truly Buddha. You know, it's one big Buddha nature, and people want to feel good. They want to feel that. That's like their birthright. They want to feel that. They just don't know how to go about it sometimes. And other times they do. I hope your rent doesn't go up. For your sake. Okay, I think we should finish. So thank you, everyone.
Beings are numerous, I vow to save them. Delusions are